Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an assessment of the damage done to the NATO mission in Afghanistan by the US Army Staff Sergeant who murdered 16 Afghan civilians, including 9 children asleep in their beds. A former Assistant Secretary of Defense in charge of manpower, Lawrence Korb, joins us to discuss the stress of multiple deployments on service personnel and the impact this tragedy may have on the planned US withdrawal. Then we will speak with Kim Barker, the author of The Taliban Shuffle, Strange Days in Afghanistan and Pakistan. The former South Asia Bureau Chief for the Chicago Tribune, she is now the Edward R. Murrow Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. And we will discuss the vexed and tragic relationship between America and Afghanistan, and at a time of acrimony and distrust, Kim Barker's affection for the Afghan people, their culture, and their country. Then finally, we'll speak with Tom Jensen, the director of Public Policy Polling, who have just released a poll on the likely outcome of tomorrow's Republican primary elections in Mississippi and Alabama, where Santorum and Gingrich are splitting the conservative vote to the extent that Romney may eke out a narrow victory in one or both states. And just before we begin, I'd like to invite you again to the UCLA Hammer Forum I'm moderating this Thursday, March the 15th at 7 p.m., buying votes. We're going to talk about how the super PACs are overwhelming our already money-driven election with Lawrence Lessig, the director of the Center for Ethics at Harvard University and the author of Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Again, this coming Thursday, March the 15th at 7 p.m. Hope you can join me. Joining us now is Lawrence Korb, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, a senior advisor to the Center of Defense Information, and a professor at Georgetown University. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense from 1981 to 1985 and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Korb.
Nice to be with you.
And clearly the murder of 16 Afghan civilians, 9 children who were asleep in their bed, is a terrible setback in terms of what's already a difficult relationship with Afghanistan, given the deadline to pull out. Do you think that this incident and the previous burning of the Qurans is going to accelerate the pullout date?
Well, I think it not only will accelerate the pullout date in terms of getting the majority of the troops out, but it'll make it very difficult to us to leave troops in there after the 2014 deadline, because we're negotiating with the Afghans right now, and they've insisted that with the remaining troops, probably special forces, no more night raids without their permission. And we're saying, no, we want to do that. Given this incident, it's going to be very hard for them to allow us to go on raids that they don't know about.
And do you think that this is a product of this long war, the longest war in American history? My understanding from anecdotal information from soldiers and officers I've talked to is that there's a kind of smoldering anger amongst U.S. soldiers in the sense that they don't feel the people in Afghanistan are grateful for the sacrifices they're making. And on the other hand, you get the impression that the Afghans see us not as liberators, but as occupiers.
Well, there's no doubt about the fact that the war has gone on so long and the troops are frustrated. And also the troops have had tremendous pressure on them. This young man, whose name we don't know, is a staff sergeant. He is on his fourth tour in 11 years in the service. According to what you're supposed to do to make sure that the troops' mental health is guarded, you should have at least 2 years in between each deployment. This young man obviously is not. There's 3 tours in Iraq, 1 in Afghanistan, and then seeing some of his fellow soldiers killed by Afghans that they were theoretically training to protect the population may have just caused him to snap. The base he comes from, Fort Lewis out there, they've had a record number of suicides last year and people with mental problems. You've had soldiers on those bases after coming back killing civilians, killing each other.
Fill us in a little more, if you can, on what you just told us about the incident that this soldier may have witnessed where U.S. trainers were killed by their Afghan students, if you will.
Well, what we've seen is that you've had soldiers who we've trained were actually, Taliban people that we didn't know about. They got into the Afghan security forces. They turned on not just Americans, but they killed British people. You've had Americans killed working in the embassies, or I should say the ministries of Afghanistan as well. So over the last month, you've had probably about a dozen of the Allied troops killed by the people they were supposed to be training to carry out the missions.
Well, there are a lot of media reports saying that this soldier is a member of the 2nd, 3rd Infantry, 3rd Striker Brigade combat team, which, of course, is based in Washington State at Fort Lewis. But this is the same base that was home to the so-called kill team, which was this rogue unit led by Sergeant Calvin Gibbs that kept all those grisly souvenirs of Afghans that they'd murdered.
Yeah, no doubt about it. They back in 2010, they were part of what they called the kill squad, and four of them have actually been convicted. You also had a soldier there at Fort Lewis that is believed to have shot a Washington Park Ranger to death on New Year's Day. And 12 soldiers on the base have committed suicide in 2010, and we don't know what the number is for 2011 yet either.
Well, you used to be in charge of manpower. I mean, what kind of screening do we have? What kind of follow-on? You were saying earlier that this particular sergeant, and nobody's condoning in any way what he did, but we're trying to understand why he did it. You're saying that he's had multiple deployments without the necessary break going back home. I take it he's also a father of a two-year-old, isn't he?
Right. He's a father. And when you mentioned I was there in the manpower area, what we instilled, the policy was that for every year you spend in a combat zone, at least 2 years at home. Well, obviously, if he's been in the service 11 years and this is his fourth deployment, there's no way he's had the 2 years in between deployments. And that enables you to get your life back together again and then be ready to go back. And it'll be interesting to see if, in fact, he was cleared to go back, into Afghanistan last December. And this is, not the first incident. We've had, similar incidents in Iraq where the troops have snapped and done things that they should not. And remember, and I don't know, who this person is, we relaxed our standards quite a bit as the wars in Iraq particularly became unpopular from 2003 to, 2008. And whether this person should have been taken in, whether he should have been allowed to stay in, is another question we're going to have to take a look at.
And of course, there was the massacre that the Marines took place in, which we're familiar with out here because we're close to Camp Pendleton.
Place in Haditha.
Haditha, right? Yes.
Right, and you just had the other situation there where the Marines were urinating on the corpses of a dead Afghan.
So, does this tell us anything about a lack of training, Lawrence Corp? Since you were in charge of manpower, you would think. I understand there been what they loosely refer to as sensitivity training, but clearly that didn't work in the case of the Quran. There are some indications. There's a group you may well be familiar with, Lawrence Korb, who have argued for some time that there's too much Christian proselytizing within the ranks. Would that be an explanation for the lack of sensitivity, for example, to the Quran burning?
Well, I think the problem is these are young men and women who really have not had the training to understand the culture that they've been thrown into. And, for many people, Christians and Jewish people, the Bible is holy, but it's not the same as the Quran. That's much more important to Muslims than say the Bible would be to Christians or Jewish people. And I think the fact of the matter is that these people are thrown into an environment in which it's very hard for them to comprehend. And given the fact that they come in, they get, training in combat skills and then get sent over. They have a little bit of training for the culture, but it's really not. You can't understand the culture of a country like Afghanistan, in a matter of months. You've got scholars who take years to understand it.
But we're talking about an American culture here, Lawrence Korb, in which good percentage, at least in Mississippi, and according to recent polls about the forthcoming election there tomorrow, 40% of Mississippi Republican voters believe that Obama is a Muslim. Franklin Graham, the son of Billy Graham, made that inference recently. We already have in this country, I think, tremendous bigotry and ignorance about religion. And, well, and you'd think that given that baseline, there'd be some fairly aggressive training going on about how important the Quran and Islam is to these people that you're supposed to be helping.
Yes, you would hope so. But again, remember that you've got people in this country, unfortunately, talk about the enemy is Islam, not Al-Qaeda. And you've heard terms like Islamofascism that, you know, people use. And these young people can be susceptible to it. In my view, the country is at fault here, not the young people we throw into these environments without enough time in between deployments. Our real failure was our volunteer military was not constructed to fight long wars. We should have activated the selective service system. This would have given us more time to train the people to undertake these missions, because they're not being asked just to do combat missions. They're asked to do, you know, counterinsurgency and nation building, and that's much more complex than just, you know, regular combat missions.
And as you mentioned earlier, during Iraq, when there was a manpower shortage, they reduced the standards down right to, was it Category 4?
Well, it's not only Category 4, but they were giving moral waivers. There's a young man in jail now in Kentucky. His name is Private Stephen Green, who was a high school dropout, had, you know, criminal convictions and a personality problem. They took him in, and when this kid got over to Iraq, he raped a young girl and killed the family. And that's the type of thing, you know, that you've had. And again, even people who don't have these particular, you know, mental situations where they come in with these back-to-back deployments and not enough time to stay home, get their lives back together, get the treatment that they need, thrust back in, it's no wonder that they break sometimes.
Again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Korb, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information, and also a professor at Georgetown University. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense from 1981 to 1985 and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. Lawrence Korb, most of the Afghan experts, and you mentioned that they're few and far between, very few, I happen to know Chris Fair very well, who speaks all the languages, and I think is one of the best analysts there. She and many others, Marvin Weinbaum and others, tell me, because I try and stay in touch with this issue, pretty much agree that there's going to be a civil war when we pull out. Is that your reading?
Well, it really depends upon whether you can get a government in Kabul that is seen as not corrupt and has the interests of the people at heart. And that's something that no matter how long we stay, you know, we really can't change. And I think, you know, people like Christine and Marvin are correct that if they don't, then obviously the Taliban will try and come back. And the real question is, will they take Al-Qaeda back? Will the Taliban do the horrible things that they did when they were in power the last time? Will they destabilize the region? And these are issues that we've got to work on, because we're on our way out. The question is really how quickly, and does this event make it, accelerate our timetable?
Well, clearly our relations with Pakistan are central to this issue. And my understanding is that since the bombing of the Afghan border post that resulted in the death of 24 Pakistani soldiers, the access for supplies through Pakistan and through the Khyber Pass are still closed. What's the update on that?
Well, basically, they're going to let some come through, but they're going to raise the price here. But you're right, they did close it for a while, and we had to get the supplies in coming through Russia and their former republics to get it in there, which, of course, increased the cost exponentially. I mean, it cost, you know, over $1 million for every man or woman you have on the ground by the time you count all what's necessary to get them the supplies.
And we got 78,000 on the ground, is that right?
That's what, right now. Well, basically, we have close to 100,000. We're going to be taking some out this year. The so-called surge, 30-some-odd thousand, which will get us to 68,000 by the end of 2012, unless we accelerate it.
So you got 100,000 at a million ahead.
That's correct, and that's why if you look at the what they call the, you know, supplemental or the OCO, Overseas Contingency Operation budget this year, you know, the vast majority, it's $100 million to, you know, Afghanistan. Iraq has obviously come down quite substantially because we're, you know, all of our military is out.
So what's your understanding of where we stand in terms of a dialogue or liaison with the Pakistan military, in particular the ISI? Obviously, there's been a very contentious relationship since bin Laden was killed right there next to the military academy. And there's a new head of ISI who's apparently sort of media savvy, but that's about all I've heard about him. One of the things that I find extraordinary is that there's so much anti-Americanism in Pakistan, and the military are clearly supporting Imran Khan, the cricket player, who's very popular and who's running on a stridently anti-American ticket. I'm wondering if the Pakistani military leadership are so intensely anti-American that they can't sort of see the forest for the trees, to the extent that if the Taliban take over in Afghanistan, which most people predict would be the case, that would then become a pretty dangerous possibility that the Afghan Taliban and the Pakistan Taliban can get together and overwhelm the Pakistan state.
Well, I don't think they can do that, but I think the real danger is, will the Pakistanis work with us to get the Taliban to come to the table to make some sort of power sharing arrangement? But I think you're quite right. I mean, if it were up to me, I wouldn't give the Pakistan military any aid. I'd give aid to the people of Pakistan because they don't like us, and basically the military is able to play on that. And by saying, well, we'll give you aid if you fight, they'll do what they need to do. When I was in Pakistan and the Taliban kind of broke out of the Northwest Territories and came down toward Islamabad, boy, the military went after them then. So they'll fight to maintain the state, but they have their Taliban. They'd like to see them in Afghanistan to make sure India doesn't have any influence there.
Well, I would use the sort of the guard dog analogy, you know, that you have a pit bull that you train to be aggressive, and then one day it takes over the entire house and you become a prisoner.
Well, that's true. I mean, I think that's an interesting analogy, and I think you certainly have to be careful, but I think they certainly are aware of that. But you're right. I mean, you play with fire, you can get burnt, but they're trying to use the so-called Haqqani network, which is kind of the Pakistan Taliban, you know, for their own aims. The real issue is, are they going to be working with, you know, us in the negotiations in Qatar to come to some sort of, you know, peaceful arrangement there? And the other country we have to work with to ever get this Afghan situation under control is Iran. Iran has an influence. The Northern Alliance people were, you know, their proteges that they kept to keep the Taliban from taking control over the whole country.
Well, there are arguments, though, that the social fabric of Afghanistan has been so torn that it's difficult to imagine that you could reconstruct a kind of Northern Alliance, which is the status quo ante before the U.S. Got involved after 9/11. And, you know, they were fighting a civil war there for some time. Mm-hmm. And my understanding the Pakistani, the really good Pakistani scholar, I wish I could think of his name, Rashid, I think it is. Do you know who I'm talking
about? Ahmad Rashid,
right. Let me repeat that. The Pakistani analyst Ahmad Rashid said that the social fabric of Afghanistan has been torn irreparably. So is there the assumption that Iran has influence may not be it may be the case in the area around what's the name of their capital there? In the Shia area of Afghanistan. But the idea that the Shia and the Uzbeks the Tajiks could get together again, apparently is questionable.
Well, I think you're right, but they do. You're quite right. But I mean, the solution to making sure Afghanistan doesn't destabilize the region is have to involve all of the neighboring countries. And you're right. The challenge for us is it'd be great if we could put Afghanistan society back together again. But the real thing is, does it threaten the region? Does it become a haven for al-Qaeda? I was in Afghanistan with Ahmad Rashid just about a year ago at this time. And, you know, he knew Karzai, and we met with a lot of the, you know, people there. And our report that we put out was basically, you've got to begin negotiating because you can't win this thing. And right now, as long as we keep forces there, the Taliban can't win either. So let's negotiate some sort of, you know, solution and then get the neighbors involved.
Well, but if you go back to when we invaded, my understanding is that amongst the Afghans, not just the elite in Kabul, but in throughout the country, there was this sense of relief that the Taliban had gone. And there was this belief that, you know, the Americans, after all, the people who put a man on the moon, they can surely help us. And it looks as though the Bush administration had absolutely no interest in doing much there, particularly in what, and they had such disdain for nation building. There were years went by when nothing happened. And now we see this Wall Street Journal did a recent article that in 2011, something like $5 billion in cash have very casually gone through the airport at Kabul on the way to banks in the Gulf. It looks as though the elite are stealing all of the aid money that we're giving that country, and that the people haven't really got much to show for the, what's it going to be, a bill of about $1 trillion at the end of the day?
Right. That's right. There's no doubt about the fact that, you know, basically, when we drove the Taliban out and everything, we did not recognize, you know, what needed to be done. And the Bush administration shifted its attention to Iraq before the job was done. This allowed, of course, the Taliban to come back in. And then, of course, Obama was handed this mess, and he was trying to fix it. The real question is it too late to get it back together again? Because you're quite right. I mean, you have so much corruption. That's why the people don't trust the government and don't want to rally around. They also think, you know, when we were there, and again, when I was there with Ahmad Rashid, we met with Ismail Khan, who's the Lion of Herat. And he said to us, he said, you come in here in 2001, you had 850 people, you drove the Taliban out. Now you got 100,000, you can't win. What's the problem? You know, I mean, we just let the thing, we missed the golden moment.
Well, just in closing, Lawrence Korb, given what we're talking about, for the average U.S. soldier, they must wonder why we're here. If we're wondering why we're here, they're there losing their buddies and feeling the anger of the local people that they're supposed to be helping, and yet there doesn't seem to be any gratitude. And on the other hand, from the Afghans' point of view, the U.S. soldiers haven't helped them, and they're looking more and more like occupiers. And now that this massacre has taken place, it's even worse. What's your sense, having been in charge of manpower, of the real nature of the morale there? Because I have a feeling that most of our soldiers want to get the hell out of there.
Well, you're quite right. It's very interesting. You know which Republican candidate gets the most contributions from active duty military people? Ron Paul.
And he's steadfastly saying we should get out.
He wants to get out. You're right, because they see no end in sight. And it's over and over again, back, and, you know, and it doesn't seem to be, you know, any end game. And they see their, you know, fellow soldiers and Marines dying, and they wonder, well, you know, what's it all about? And it's not just the ones who are dying, the ones who are wounded. I mean, it used to be, you know, if every three people wounded, one died. Now it's for every 15 wounded, only one dies. So in addition to the, you know, the people who die, you got these, you know, people who are going to be wounded for the and suffer the consequences for the rest of their lives.
Well, Lawrence Gorb, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Gorb, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information and a professor at Georgetown University. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense from 1981 to 1985 and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the author of The Taliban Shuffle. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. Even if he has to go wrong.